are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 13th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Tuesday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Eric Levitz, associate editor at New York Magazine, on why we must cancel all student debts now for the sake of the economy, society, and everything else. Donald Trump and his administration have released a new budget. Does not eliminate the deficit. Does call for savage cuts in healthcare, hitting Medicaid particularly hard. A re-up on Graham Cassidy, assault on Obamacare. Plus, underfunding the opioid crisis. More broadly, the budget hits the poor the hardest, which calls for a massive redesign of the SNAP program, cuts to HUD, and all sorts of other sociopathic...
You can cut HUD.
You can cut HUD anytime. But when they're not working to make people starve and more hungry, they're also proposing a restructuring of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and further cuts in that watchdog over Wall Street. The African National Congress has removed Jacob Zuma as its leader. He will step down, presumably, soon. Cyril Ramaphosa set to take over as head of the ANC in 2019, rather. There will presumably be a caretaker leader in between. Russian troops killed in airstrikes in Syria. And Trump's controversial pick to run the 2020 consensus has actually withdrawn. The Department of Education says it will reject transgender student bathroom complaints. Nothing like adding to a little more lack of safety for students. All that and more. Today's Majority Report. It's the three of us. It's the three amigos. Michael, Matt, and Brendan.
Depart, amigos.
What'd you say?
Depart him.
Depart all three of them.
Just the three of us.
Oh, nice.
Little Willie nice style, little, huh?
Respect. Guys. Donald Trump's new budget is a perfect encapsulation of the modern Republican philosophy. It's vicious. It's cruel. It benefits only an incredibly small amount of society. It will increase hunger. It will increase uninsured rates. It will dramatically increase human suffering. It is the end point of this decades of neoliberal buildup, deregulation, and assaults on the safety net. Paul Ryan is speaking with Maria Bartiromo, who's one of Trump's favorite propagandists, and she's going to confront him because, you see, in this new budget that was passed in order to keep government going, that, of course, did nothing to protect DACA recipients, that was very beneficial to most Republican policy goals. See, there were still some few marginal things in there that actually benefited people, like community health centers. So Maria Bartiromo is going to have on Paul Ryan, who still is a very strong contender for the absolute worst person in American and maybe global public life. And she's going to put his feet to the fire for not causing enough human suffering on Fox Business.
what it did to the military. So we want to rebuild our military, and we did a few things since those days. We've put in about $250 billion of permanent mandatory spending cuts in that course of time. In this bill, we have Medicare means testing we've added to it. We got rid of the Independent Payment Advisory Board, a big down payment on health care reform. So we've actually done some things in this bill that we think are pretty important. But yeah, we did have more domestic spending. And the domestic spending we put in here is pretty much one-time spending. Disaster aid, infrastructure aid, in exchange for getting the military budget we wanted.
Yeah, but
here's the question. We got to get on entitlements.
Yeah.
And so this was a discretionary spending budget. This wasn't a full macro budget. This was discretionary spending. And for us, save the military, one-time spending for hurricanes, disaster, get some spending cuts that will grow in the out years. But we do have to go back and focus on entitlement spending. The House Republicans passed the biggest entitlement reform package ever when we passed our health care bill. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, somebody did this instead of that in the Senate, and it didn't pass. Yeah. We passed a budget before that cut $7.4 trillion in spending over 10 years in the House. The problem is we have to get our other partners in government to be willing to do the kind of entitlement reform that we're willing to do in the House.
Which is why people are surprised at you, because you've been this entitlement reform person and a deficit hawk for years.
And
you
mentioned
running the budget, but you don't look like you are based on this budget last week.
I mean, this isn't a full budget. This is discretionary spending.
Well, you mentioned discretionary. I mean, you're also a big boost to abstinence education, $7 billion in community health centers, child care grants. So it's more than just the disaster relief and infrastructure.
True. So this is a bipartisan
budget. Did you have to agree to that stuff just to get the military money?
Yeah, we had to. You have to give to get. So we had to do some domestic spending that the Democrats wanted so we could get our defense spending. We got a lot of the spending cuts we wanted that they didn't want either. So yes, this was a bipartisan compromise. You don't get everything you want. And what I would simply say is look at what the House has already proven our ability to do on entitlements. We have passed every year since we've been in the majority. Every term, big entitlement savings. The problem we have is we can't get these things through the Senate. Our health care bill, people look at it as the repeal and replace bill. That was an enormous entitlement reform bill.
Right.
For Medicaid, for Obamacare. We passed it out of the House. We couldn't get it through the Senate. So, yeah, we've got more to do on entitlements, on mandatory spending. We added more Medicare means testing in this particular bill. So we think we're making progress on that. But what we have to make sure is we don't hollow out our military.
Right.
So let's be clear about this first. Obviously, things like abstinence education are being pushed by Republican members of the caucus. Community health clinics benefit rural America. So there is some basic Republican hypocrisies here on domestic spending. Obviously, no surprise there. The moral framework and the moral context of this conversation is disgusting because, of course, they're basically just talking about throwing more and more people out of healthcare, causing more premature deaths and human suffering, and redistributing wealth. We already know that that's the purpose of Republican policymaking. And he is right. The House bill they passed would have been incredibly savage on the social safety net. This is all going to come back and is in the Trump budget. The Trump budget has about $1.4 trillion in Medicaid cuts, which it's taking off of from the Graham-Cassidy bill. It denies benefits to people who cannot approve their immigration status. That's $2.2 billion in cuts over 10 years. Increases beneficiaries' co-payments for improper use of an emergency room. How is that defined and by whom? $1.3 billion. Allows asset testing, which adds up the value of a person's property and belongings in addition to income to test Medicare eligibility. There are an additional $266 billion in Medicare cuts proposed in the Trump budget in the name of eliminating wasteful spending, though they're largely cuts in payments to healthcare providers rather than cuts in eligibility or benefits. This is according to Vox. Combine that with the fact that this is also going to be this budget proposes a massive assault on the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, which is a version of food stamps run by the Agriculture Department. The White House proposed cutting $214 billion from the program over 10 years, although Congress often fights about changing SNAP and rarely has enacted changes. Again, and that's from the Washington Post, again, because SNAP, of course, affects and benefits many Republican constituents. It's a universal program that rises to meet the demands and the needs of people who meet their eligibilities. It's not a block granted program. And already the assistance you get from SNAP, and I could say this as somebody whose family was saved by SNAP at times growing up, are incredibly modest. And still, in fact, a family can deal with serious food insecurity and hunger. So Maria Bartiromo doesn't need to worry, and we can all rest assured that Paul Ryan is coming for those crumbs to redistribute more money to the Kochs, arms contractors, and everyone else, and many Democrats will go along with it.
That's what's really insidious about this interview, the way it's framed, is yes. Like this was framed as Bartiromo grills Paul Ryan on deficit hockery, but she led him exactly where he wants to go. Which yeah. is like what we did, that necessary military stuff that I know, Maria, you're not going to question at all.
Right.
That's going to give us more leverage to squeeze entitlements. And that's the only place Maria wanted to go. And yet all these places say, look at Maria grilling him on, is he really a deficit hawk? Yeah.
And for all those people who might think that Fox News and all these things are not relevant to the political conversations that we're having, like, how do you think taking away SNAP got its popularity? It's those stories about people buying shrimp with fucking SNAP.
Right. It's all of those lies and distortions and actually, and frankly, just things that shouldn't matter to you that were spread through the right-wing media ecosystem, of which Fox is still the main propaganda outlet and Fox Business. So absolutely. And of course, that's where Ryan wants to go. And that's how surface level and embarrassing media coverage is, that it's like, oh, well, Maria really gave him a run for his money by, as Matt said, exactly facilitating the conversation he wants for the next phase of making America poorer, sicker, and dumber. Folks, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Eric Levitz to talk about universal cancellation of college student loans. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Eric Levitz. He's an associate editor at New York Magazine. Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Doing well, Eric. Thanks again for joining us. You have a new piece out, Why We Must Cancel Everyone's Student Debt for the Economy's Sake. What's the basic case here?
Well, basically, to start off with, you know, we just basically added $1.5 trillion to our public debt for the sake of distributing loads, hundreds of billions of dollars to the wealthy and corporations. And the justification for this policy was that, you know, this is going to spur economic growth and increase wages, and thus, you know, we're all going to benefit. Like, even if you kind of have a knee-jerk objection to giving Wyatt Coke a few billion more dollars in inheritance, ultimately the net effect of throwing all this cash into the economy is going to benefit everybody. So why are you complaining?
And make more great, amazing, just really discoteca shirts that are amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So right. I think that the logic of that argument really applies so much more powerfully to the idea of canceling all student debt, which ironically is about the same, is about as costly a proposition. It's $1.4 trillion of outstanding debt right now. So for a slightly less money, we could wipe out all this debt. And there's this new study from the Levy Institute of the Levy Economic Institute of Bard College, which actually these progressive economists, Marshall Steinbaum, Stephanie Kelton, who used to advise Bernie Sanders, or maybe still does among them, basically ran the numbers on what would happen if the government, which actually owns about 90% of all student debt, just forgave all that debt and bought out the private holders of it. So wiped out that $1.4 trillion, what would happen to the economy? And what they find is that, you know, right now that student debt is depressing consumer demand in a profound way. Right now you have so many young households that are so burdened by their student debt that they're not buying cars, they're not buying houses, and you know, maybe even more critically, they're not having kids and not engaging in all the consumption that proceeds from starting a family. And so what this is doing is, you know, really dampening consumer demand and dampening economic growth. And so if we were to wipe all that out, by their calculations, we would increase real GDP by as much as between $860 trillion over 10 years to something over $1 trillion, while also creating about 1.2 million jobs a year and reducing the unemployment rate over time by up to about a third of a percent. So significant macroeconomic benefits.
We are extremely not worried about deficits on this show, but in standard media discourse somehow, I mean, we were just playing it before, somehow Maria Bartiromo was leveraging the recently passed spending bill to keep government going as a new opening of the flank for Paul. And it was portrayed as, you know, she was grilling Paul Ryan, but of course it's right where he wants to go. The next phase of attacks on America's very small social safety net. That will probably be one of the main, like, if this issue starts to gain any public, you know, broader public traction, and we'll get to that later, the first objection, kind of knee-jerk thing to anything that would benefit the economy and society is, well, the deficit. So is there a specific answer to that?
You know, I don't think there is, aside from, you know, just pointing out, again, this is the exact same price as those tax cuts. And so, you know, if it's okay for them to do that, why isn't it? I mean, basically just, you know, using the Republican behavior in office to argue that, you know, apparently we all believe that deficits don't matter now. And I really don't think that the deficit actually is the biggest obstacle to this political proposition.
Oh, definitely
I think
not
real
the
problem
biggest.
That it,
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Just that the real problem is that there is there are real inequities inherent to this proposal that are going to trouble a lot of people for understandable reasons, at least on first brush. You know, obviously they're the people who just paid off their $300,000 in student debt or even, you know, smaller amounts than that, but who have for years been making these sacrifices and living this austere existence so that they could pay off theirs. And then now people are getting these things forgiven. And then additionally, you know, those who did not have the opportunity to go to college you know, chose specifically not to go to college because they felt they couldn't afford it. And now are seeing, you know, their financial probity turn into this like actual terrible mistake that they, their lives would have been so much better if they had realized that the debt wasn't real. So there are these real, you know, legitimate resentments that this could create. And I think that my point is just that, you know, getting perspective, both in terms of this, you know, tax cut and broader just fighting this idea of what I think, you know, you can call like status quo bias, right? Which I think Matt Brunig years ago about reparations wrote a really solid piece on this, but just about how people were really made uncomfortable hit the idea of, you know, well, what if a reparations benefits this, like, a, you know, rich black family, and you're transferring money from poor white people to rich black people or something, mm-hmm. Or this specific, like, instance, whatever. But that's all on the presumption that, like, doing anything, this idea of, like, do no harm, even if in the aggregate you're doing good. So he argued basically, well, look at the post. Imagine that we were living in the post reparations world. Mm-hmm. Would anybody argue that it would be more just to go from that world to our current one, that it would be more just to redistribute because some African-American families now have more than maybe we think that they should or something, that we should take all that money and give it back? So I think it's similar, mm-hmm. idea applies here, that even if there are losers, that the post student at Jubilee world is a more just world than the one that we currently live in.
Right. It will open up new economic activity, jobs, wages for everyone. The other thing that is going to come up in this is going to be exactly, I mean, who holds student debt? Another area for, and I think this will also sort of poke some of the familiar debates between, you know, neoliberals and centrists and people on the left, and the argument between universal delivery and universal programs and emancipation versus sort of micro-targeted minor adjustments. Who is primarily, like, where on the economic scale do these debts primarily fall? What is the economic and racial makeup of that? And how could that affect this debate, at least inside the center and the left? I don't think this holds much currency with the right one way or another.
Right. So there's the complexity to that in that, you know, the highest, like, absolute debt loads are held by people who generally come from the upper middle class, because those are the people that are going to fancy private colleges with really high tuition.
Right.
And so on first blush, this can look like a not very progressive proposal. But the thing is that the people who are suffering most from student debt, the delinquency rates are highest among working class non-white
right.
students,
right.
You know, because they're the ones who are taking on this credit often to go to less prestigious institutions and less just a, you know, good educational
institution. Yeah, and at times, I mean, scams, like the online scam system.
Yeah, mm-hmm. correct. They're very vulnerable to scam colleges right. as well. But even beyond that, you know, ones who went to perfectly decent schools, they enter a labor market that has a lot of structural racism built into it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I think maybe even more importantly, they come from disproportionately backgrounds where their families don't have, rather than, you know, an expectation that the family is going to subsidize you in your early career,
right.
there's potentially the opposite assumption, right? And so if things don't immediately go well, you know, you're going to end up racking up significant, it's easy to fall behind on your debt if the entry-level job isn't immediately there for you, or if there's an expectation that you need to, like, work an unpaid internship or something right. on top of it, you know, you need to pay back. And so this results in really actually the student debt crisis is exacerbating the racial wealth gap because white debtors pay such less of a fiscal financial price for their decision than black ones do.
Yeah, and along a class line, I experienced a lot of the dynamics you're talking about. I mean, I came from a very low-income family, and I was able to get, you know, got a good deal to a private school, but experienced those same things of going into a tight job market, definitely not having a family that could subsidize apartments or unpaid internships or any of the other things that seemed to be almost like part of, like, elite extension school almost, or even, like, you know, kind of initial entry level jobs with very low wages. So there is this whole other infrastructure that class and race show up in that subsidize and cushion that transition. And people who don't have it are getting hit with these delinquency rates and the sort of the whole other kind of predation when we get into, like, how it affects credit scores and savings, and that's a whole other, not to mention obviously spending power and just getting your life going, that's a whole other cycle of abuse and disenfranchisement right there.
Correct.
So, go ahead.
I know, you can continue.
So, okay, so we know This would seem like this would be something that would be very, very popular politically, obviously with young people, but also with, I mean, even if we went into that other sort of class bracket, I mean, I think there's a lot of parents who are in fact voters and pretty engaged that would love to not be continuing to sort of dip into their pockets in this. Is there any sense that there's any, like, what are the politics of this that is going to get this on the map? We have free college on the map. There were some reforms that Obama put into place when he first came into office on sort of the debt collection process. But if anything, you know, it seems like, you know, sort of government as a debt collector can be just as pernicious in some way, I mean, not quite as, but also very pernicious just as the private sector. So how do we get this started? What do you think the angle is on this?
Yeah, I don't know. I think free public college is like kind of the fact that that is in the air now. It's sort of a prerequisite to this proposal because it really is hard to see how one would justify this proposal if we wiped out all the student debt and then continued to have the same method for financing public education that we currently do. You know, because we would, you'd have a situation where there's just an assumed jubilee every 15 years or something. Right. But so we need to pair this with public college. And I think that public college itself as a proposal leads it to the question, oh, you're making it free now, but what about all the people who didn't have this benefit? What are we going to do for them? And so I think the more we can get public college to be a mainstream, on the mainstream agenda, the better the prospects for debt forgiveness. I think that, you know, this is the far left pole of the debate on debt forgiveness, and there are some lesser things that you could do, like make, you know, it dischargeable in bankruptcy. Right now, student debt is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. You could set up these, you know, income-targeted sort of debt programs where you never have to pay more than a certain percentage of your income or what have you. Mm-hmm. But I think that the key for making this politically salient or politically viable and answering a lot of the objections, the core knee-jerk objections that people have to, you know, the legitimate fairness concerns of it, is like interrogating the justice of student loans. And I think what you were talking about with the government, it's actually the government is the really only collector that really can make student loans work because they can garnish your wages because of the total ability to monitor and surveil you. Mm-hmm. Because student loans are special, right? Like what the whole problem is you can't take back what somebody learned and you can't take back their diploma. So you can't take back the human capital that you've loaned them. And that's why they've written a law so that you can't discharge it in bankruptcy, because otherwise lenders would be really worried that everybody would get a medical degree, declare bankruptcy, and then make loads of money as a doctor with human capital that they accessed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what the government is doing is profiting off of, you know, loading up young people with tons of debt to access just the opportunity to participate in middle class life. You know, I think that's the real development here that's so important, is that there was a time when going to college would get you a wage premium because you could expect so much higher earnings going to college than being in the working class. Whereas now it's like a prerequisite for escaping like precarity and poverty. Right. Wages for college graduates are relatively stagnant. They've increased by about like $800 over a little over a decade. But wages for people who don't have a college degree have plummeted. And so there is still a wage premium. Going to college still makes sense. But not because life is so much better with a college degree, but because it's so much worse without one. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a political economy that we've constructed. So you have people essentially loaning, you know, their future buying power to the government for the chance to escape poverty. The government literally in some years profits off this. They take in more in payments from the loan program than they pay out. Right. So this is not a healthy relationship for the government to have to its citizens. And one that I think we can call like inherently unjust.
Definitely. So, okay. So if there's the sort of tip of the spear is public, universal, or, you know, at least universally accessible, free public college, which Bernie Sanders has put on the map and I'm sure will continue to advocate for, then we can start to sort of broaden it out and make both a justice case, but more broadly an economic case. I guess I'm persuaded by an economic case for the broad general public because the benefits are so obvious. But the sort of two stumbling blocks that I see more broadly, I mean, one, we'll take the easier one first, but one of the things that always that really cracked me up about your article is I thought about this literature that probably started like in 2010, really. And I remember all of us were like in our 20s and underemployed and whatever. And there would be like these pieces in like the New York Times, like, why aren't millennials getting on with their lives? And like, why aren't they moving up? This like mystery, like, what is it? Is it because they, you know, too many gold stars? And, you know, the sort of literature that still exists that built up all of these hinky cultural explanations, like, and some of them I think have taken on lives of their own. Like, I think that, yes, like now millennial, like clearly, like there's more value, more broadly speaking, for people in their 20s and 30s. Like, there's more goals of being in cities than suburbs, as an example. So things like cars really are less important, and there might be a transformed market for them in the future and now. And that's certainly, you know, very good news for global warming and the environment, as an example. But in a lot of other ways, like particularly to things that were terrible, like not making enough money, not being able to move out of your parents' house, not being able to have a meaningful work life. This had nothing to do with like not proper goal setting or not working hard enough or being too coddled. These were purely economic things. But it still seems that we're still trapped in that kind of like silly sort of pull your pants up cultural narrative, which will have overlap again, and I think be used like, you know, I'm already picturing the Fox segment of like, now you need to subsidize. Like, you know, first we gave them loan to study, you know, pottery, and now you're going to pay it off as a taxpayer. By golly gee.
Right.
So what do you think is the kind, I mean, do we just stick to the economic case, or do we have to get into a little bit more of the nuts and bolts of like all of these kind of trends and lifestyle pieces are nonsense, and there was a real economic conditions here that set up lower purchasing power, which has had a disastrous effect for the broader economy?
Yeah, well, I think we need to first like establish universal avocado toast so that we can just take that
exactly
off the,
right,
just guaranteed access to avocado toast.
Yeah, that's next on the docket.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that, like I said before, I think there are real like political challenges to this. I think that the virtue of this idea in a political power is that the constituency for it is intensely, but like you can, this isn't an issue where like people will say yes to a pollster. The people who say yes to this idea are ready to like knock on doors or march in the street. I mean, there are, you know, the 44 million Americans who hold student debt are very ready to have that forgiven, and and they face in the daily lives a constant reminder of this limitation on their freedom. And so the intensity of the support for this proposal will be great. It'll be great for mobilizing. It will have a backlash, you know, because there is already so much resentment. You know, still most Americans don't go to college.
Right.
And in the rural areas where Republicans do well, where Trump does well, there's intense resentment of the opportunities. And the, like I talked about before, this great divergence between the life outcomes of people with and without college degrees and who, you know, are intellectually skilled versus manually skilled or have different, you know, abilities and ways of contributing. And there's a legitimacy to that feeling, especially because part of why the government's encouragement of taking on these loans and everything in our policy is so screwed up is because the knowledge economy is in many ways a lie.
Right.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that in the next 20 years, the fastest growing occupations, I think like 14 out of 20 of them, do not require a college degree. It's home health care, it's
right,
whatever, all these service professions that don't require a bachelor's.
Right.
So why are we subsidizing like the people who are going to make more money and not doing anything? So I think that the best way to combat that is to put it as one part of a progressive agenda that again, like just like pairing it with public college for the people coming up now, but also, you know, federal job guarantee or whatever, something, you know, provide real answers for the people who are not, this is not their struggle, but they have, but they're still struggling from so many of the same things, from the decreased purchasing power and from all the things that you were talking about. And so I do think that they're presented in the absence of other parts of an agenda that benefit working class young people who are trying to get their foot in the door of a profession that does not require a college degree. If we're not doing anything for them, then I think we will be exposed to these arguments of classism and make Fox News' job easier. So I think that it needs to be part integrated into a broader progressive agenda for young people.
Yeah, I agree completely. Final question. I mean, I think you're doing something. I like how you're doing this, because I think that, you know, the idea of pointing out the hypocrisy of Republicans or any, you know, really essentially just sort of corporate pawn politician, but particularly Republicans. I mean, it's just, it's useless. Like, of course, there's unending hypocrisy, and that's a given. But do you think that the basic, not as a tool to, you know, because we know the obviously the Republican Party and any Democrat, you know, Tom Harkin had this reputation as a great liberal. He was terrible on the student loan issue, as an example, before he retired recently. But I feel like the way you're using it is not, you know, there's never going to be a shame for Republicans doing the right thing, but it's a handy bullet point to say, and is this how you're using it? Like to say that number of universal student loan forgiveness is the same as this massive wealth giveaway to the wealthy and corporations. So it's totally doable. It's totally achievable. Congress does things with this type of money all the time. It's just that this, what they do with that money doesn't benefit you as a non-ultra-elite person. So let's take the same price tag and do something for you and the economy as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, it works in two ways. Just so much of the Republican argument against progressive priorities hinges on there is no alternative, it's just not possible. You know, simply put, you know, they can't win the argument if we stipulate that what Denmark does is possible in the United States. You know, and if you look at just even the debates over Medicare for All that they did on CNN with like Bernie and Lindsey Graham or something, like it always comes down to, well, you know, you do this, then we're going to have to take away Medicare from people we have now because it's not possible to do this for everybody. It's just, and so, yeah, right, pointing out that we had $1.5 trillion to just give away when it was too tax cuts for the rich and corporations. And, you know, ironically, also the increase in the Pentagon's budget that they just passed is about equal to what it would cost to establish free public college. And so, you know, the money is not hard to come by, apparently. But so there's that element of it. The other element that I wanted specifically, though, was for to combat the stronger objection is like, you know, the upper middle class kid who went to Harvard, but you know, parents were stingy or they wanted whatever, like they took out $300,000 in loans, and yeah, they're not as privileged as the Harvard graduate who didn't have loans, but you know, had all this different forms of privilege and gone into finance, and they're going to make back their loans and more, and they're going to be fine. And we're transferring money to that person. You know, I think that like knee-jerk objection is what I'm trying to preempt by saying, well, look, you know, look at what we were willing to accept for tax cuts. You know, look at how much money we're willing to transfer to in individual cases where it seems kind of unjust, but on the grounds that this is what's best for the whole economy. You know, nobody, Republican or Democrat, really thinks that it's a good public policy goal to make Harvey Weinstein richer. But like, if that's like one
well, the Republicans
micro
do,
effect
actually.
Of a
right.
Well, yeah. But specifically, you said his
right.
specific name.
Right, fair enough.
But like,
yeah.
Even if like in individual cases, we are objecting to the effect, and it seems like unjust in this individual case that, you know, public policy is about macro effects, and the macro effect of forgiving student loans would be far superior to that of, you know, a giant regressive tax cut.
Absolutely. Eric Levitz, New York Magazine. The piece, which we have linked to on the majority.fm website, is "We Must Cancel Everyone's Student Debt for the Economy's Sake." Eric, as always, I appreciate your time.
Yep, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Folks, tonight, The Michael Brooks Show, ContraPoint, and Bree Brianna Joy Gray joins me in studio. We might be getting a check-in call from Mike Hanna because of the news that just came out of South Africa today. ContraPoint and I are talking about Jordan Peterson, among other things. Should be fascinating. Bree and I are talking about Me Too and many other things as well. Plus, of course, the post-game. We've had and streaming.
Prior to that,
my promise that once we've crossed our first 1,000 patrons, I have to think of a good, like, something, like, when we get to 2,000 patrons, it's going to have to be, like, I don't know, you know, like, some type of, like, going to, like, a sneaker exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum or something and Snapchatting it. Something more in my lane.
Periscoping.
I don't know.
People just want to watch you do something.
No, I could talk
anyway
about the sneakers.
Michael okay eats a roti.
Michael eats a... I don't eat... I haven't, you know what? I would like to eat a roti, but I don't think I will have eating on camera as a reward for people. but tonight, 6:15, I'm going to be playing Wolfenstein with Matt. We were practicing last night.
Might start around 6. We'll see.
We'll start around, yeah, or in that ballpark. So that's happening.
Keep an eye on Twitter or... Yeah.
Thanks,
Matt,
sir.
In that warm-up, how did Michael look on the sticks?
He finally figured out how to sort of navigate the 3D space, you know, without bumping into walls. But he is really good at shooting people's kneecaps.
I'm super into shooting people's kneecaps. Like, I try to, like, I feel basically my guy is like a fearless, sadistic, deeply mentally and physically incapacitated person. That's basically my guy.
I like the backstory you've built out for yourself.
Yeah,
when you play video games.
Yeah, well, that's how I needed to get into it.
It's on low difficulty, so you can take a lot of damage.
I could also take a lot of damage.
The aim is not
so good. I'm like Andre the Giant or something. So patreon.com/TMBS. Check out the Michael Brooks Show on iTunes, Michael Brooks Show on the our YouTube channel. We're setting up our own YouTube channel and are going to be starting to do discrete clips on that as well. I mean, the full show will still be on Majority Report, but clips will be on that as well. We're really growing with that. So thanks, everybody, as always. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. I think there's still 10% off with the code MAJORITY. Jet.com, a Majority Report kickback. Leave the Majority Report a review on iTunes. Tell everybody about our YouTube page. Subscriptions on that are skyrocketing. Can follow all of us. Follow Majority.fm on Twitter. Like Majority Report on Facebook. At Matt Leck on Twitter. What are you on Twitter, Brendan?
BF1NN.
And I'm at _MichaelBrooks, at Sam Cedar, and I believe, what is Jamie's, at Bernie Bangs? Is that right?
That's her username, but I can't remember that.
Someone looked that up really quick. I want to pitch everybody's Twitter.
That is Jamie, J-A-M-I-E, _Elizabeth.
Jamie_Elizabeth. All right, everybody. 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You're